Welcome to Best True Crime Podcast, a division of Best True Crime Books, Games, and Video, LLC. I'm your lead investigator on this case, Judith A. Yates, award-winning true crime author, a criminologist, and a paranormal explorer. Every episode is an investigation where you and I explore true crime, forensics, historic cases, dark history, and criminal theory. We discuss the cases, share information, no chatter, no commercials, no off-topic. Now, grab your crime scene kit, a notebook, and your favorite hat. This is Best True Crime Podcast. By the time of her execution at 36, Maria Mandel had achieved the highest rank possible for a woman in the Third Reich. As head overseer of the women's camp of Auschwitz-Birkenau, she was personally responsible for the murders of thousands and for the torture and suffering of countless more. In this riveting biography, Susan J. Eichscheid explores how Maria Mandel, regarded locally as a nice girl from a good family, comes to embody the very worst of humanity. I'm reading from the inside cover page from the book Mistress of Death, The Dark Journey of Maria Mandel, Head Overseer of the Women's Camp at Auschwitz-Birkenau. It's a book by author Susan J. Eichscheid. It's a well-written, well-researched book about one of the most feared women who worked at a World War II concentration camp in Nazi Germany. And today, we are having a conversation with Susan about the book, her research, and how an author can write about one of the darkest periods of world history, the Holocaust. Okay, today I'm having a conversation with Susan J. Eichscheid. Her book is called Mistress of Life and Death, The Dark Journey of Maria Mandel, Head Overseer of the Women's Camp at Auschwitz-Birkenau. Hello, Susan.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for agreeing. I mean, we've been talking off and on for a while, and now we're finally meeting.
I'm thrilled to be able to speak with you about this book.
Well, I tell you what, this book is amazing. Such an interesting read. Just the information you obtained, the personalities that you were able to flesh out, and you had an excellent balance of the situation that this person was involved in and this person, Maria Mandel, who she was. And it really gave us an excellent look into how and why and who was involved in the quote unquote backstage of the Holocaust and the concentration camps, the horrific things that involved. And we all go, how could this happen? You know, who was involved? Were they monsters? This book really explained how this could happen and who were the quote monsters. So tell us about yourself, Susan.
Sure. Well, I guess I have a sort of unusual background to have written the book like this. In real life, I'm a professional musician and a university professor. So I actually have a doctorate in oboe performance, of all things, studied in Philadelphia and Cincinnati. Of course, as a performer, I've performed with lots of different orchestras and recorded albums and things like that. But along with my music studies, I've always had a really strong interest in the Holocaust. And eventually, when I made the decision to leave full-time orchestral playing and return to academia, I was really seeking ways I could combine these two, what seemingly disparate interests. And then I began digging into music of the Holocaust. And this was quite a while ago, so there had been very little research or scholarship done into that field. And as I began digging, I just uncovered this amazing breadth and depth of music and achievement and artistic activity. And then someone asked me if I could perform some Holocaust music at a Remembrance Day. And so for the first time, I performed some of this music. And that moment really transformed my life. I think I realized the sheer power and beauty it had, and also this great gift I had been given that through my training and my abilities as a musician, I could help give a voice back to these other musicians who had been, you know, very cruelly and prematurely killed or, you know, denied their voice. And that just led from one thing to another. I began to travel around and present programs about Holocaust music. I began to teach classes about Holocaust and the arts at my university, and I released a solo album of Holocaust music. I always knew I wanted to write a book about the subject and began to seriously pursue that idea around 2000 or 2001. At first, I envisioned a kind of general history of Holocaust music, but ultimately, I settled on telling the story of Maria Mandel, who, as you mentioned, is the subject of this new book.
What intrigued you most about Maria, about the subject of your book and how she played a role? Because I tell you what got me the most. She could play the piano beautifully and just get so wrapped up in the music. And then she steps out the door and becomes one of the most feared women in the Holocaust camps. I don't even know what to call it, but this personality was just so. What intrigued you about the subject?
Well, just to tell the listeners a tiny bit, we'll talk more about her in a minute, I guess. She definitely became one of the worst perpetrators of the Holocaust. Ultimately, became the highest ranking female SS officer in the Nazi hierarchy. And she first came to my attention when I discovered she had founded a women's orchestra in the death camp of Auschwitz-Birkenau. So that was my initial lure into her. When I began to actually write the book, at first my primary focus was on telling the story of the Auschwitz orchestra and her involvement with it. But increasingly, as I came to know this young woman, who in her hometown had always been described as a quote, nice girl from a good family, I became drawn more to trying to understand the factors that led her and so many other people in that period and beyond into this path of atrocity and evil. And ultimately, it became that transition and trying to understand that which became the major impetus behind the project rather than the musical emphasis per se. You know, far greater minds than mine have struggled with the questions of why some people are drawn to evil and some people can withstand evil and remain good. And I thought if I could just trace this one person's life, sort of fully explore her transition from good to evil, perhaps that would help us all to, you know, come to a greater understanding of what is something which is perhaps unanswerable. So that was sort of the genesis and why I began writing the book and how I got into it.
How long did it take you to write?
Well, it took about 20 years to write, another 2 years to find an agent, and then a publisher. That whole time I was working in at least 8 different languages. I had thousands of pages of archival testimonies. I had done over 100 interviews, including over 60 with Holocaust survivors. And most of those were not in English, so they all had to be translated and then transcribed. Then, of course, I had thousands of pages of material that I somehow had to organize and then put into some cogent form and begin writing. I really used to worry about how long it was taking me to write this book, but in the end, the book followed its own timeline, and I think that was for the best. I think it's happening when it should happen, and I think it evolved as it should, but it's been a big chunk of my life for sure.
Did you ever get tired of Maria Mandel and her world and writing about her and had to take a break?
No, I had to, by necessity, learn to distance myself somewhat from the material because quite often I was reading things that were truly horrific. And then, of course, when I began interviewing survivors who had lived through her brutalities, it's much different when someone is looking you in the eye and crying or describing a beating or seeing their mother killed in front of them or something. So I became very emotionally involved. But I always wanted to keep myself feeling something because I did not want to become desensitized to the material. I wanted to remain fully cognizant of all the layers of what happened because I felt in only that way could I be honest and truthful about the experiences of the survivors and the people she killed, but also sort of true to her journey and progression into what caused her to take these actions and to move forward.
One of my best friends when I was in Tennessee, and unfortunately she's no longer with us, was a Holocaust survivor, a little tiny woman. She would tell me about what had happened and what she viewed, and it made it so real. And yes. You could read about something terrible all day long, but when you're standing there listening to the person who saw it, I had nightmares when I was writing my book. I've had nightmares about every book I've written while I was in there. So you're right. You have to do this distancing, but yet you become part of these people's lives.
Exactly.
Is this your only book that you've written, or do you have any more in the plans for the next 20 years or what you got?
Well, actually, I have 3 or 4 more in the pipeline coming up. And this is actually my second book. My first book, which was published in 2016, was actually a tangent of the Mandel book, but that one ended up coming first. That's sort of an interesting story behind it. So I was lucky in the fact that I did start this project so long ago that there were still surviving members of the orchestra that Mandel founded at Auschwitz. Always when I was interviewing those members of the orchestra, one book came up which had been published about their orchestra. It was by a woman named Fania Fenelon. It was called Playing for Time. It was published in the late 1980s, and Fenelon had actually been a member of the orchestra along with these women. So she published this memoir really without consulting the other women. It immediately got on all the bestseller lists. They made a TV movie about it, which is still streaming on Netflix. And it's come to be considered sort of the ultimate source on the women's orchestra. The only problem is that Fenelon embellished or outright lied about lots of the things that were happening. She did sort of these mean portrayals. She portrayed herself as the hero of the orchestra, when in reality, if there was a hero of the orchestra, it was the conductor, Alma Rosé. Yes. And these women were just absolutely devastated. And in every interview, they just talked so much about it. And they, once I got to know them, and some of them became very dear friends, they just kept begging me to set the record straight about this book. And so at this point, you know, I was 16 years into the Mandel Project, give or take. But I said, you know, I'm just going to stop right now, and I want to address this so I can try to get something in print while these women were still living. So at first I was thinking just something like an article or maybe a book review 40 years later, what has happened with this book. But then when I began digging, the scope of the impact that this book had, it had permeated every level of Holocaust research and scholarship. It was cited by luminaries in the field, sold in the Holocaust Museum in D.C. And so at that point, I said that, you know, an article isn't enough. So I ended up doing a sort of a short book just about sort of this, the influence of this book and the real story through the mouths of the women. It wasn't a great experience in terms of being a writer. Since my goal was to get it into print fast, I went through a smaller academic press. You know, they use their own title. It was sort of an unwieldy format. It's way overpriced in the market. You know, I think I got like a $300 flat fee or something, but I was never in it for the money. But my major goal of getting it into print before most of them died was achieved. And there was actually a very dramatic moment near the end. In the last year, I had lined up the publisher. We were in the final drafts. And I got word that one of the women to whom I'd become very close, Helena Novinska, had been taken to the hospital and she was on her deathbed. Aww. And so I got this urgent call from my translator, Susan, my God, Helena is dying. Is there any way you can email me the manuscript just so she can see this before she dies? So, you know, I shot it off by email. My translator ran to the hospital, began reading her the manuscript of the book. And I forgot to mention that Helena was now 103 years old, so she had already lived a really long time. And she was always my biggest critic and my biggest supporter. You know, if I got it wrong, she set me right. And I just respected her so much and loved her so much. And I guess when they started reading her the manuscript on her deathbed, she rallied because she had to give me more input. So she actually survived that crisis and lived about another year, and then in the end she did leave to see the actual publication of the book. So I was very, very glad and grateful I could take that tangent from the Mandel book, and I would never have known about this other topic had I not been pursuing the Mandel research. So that's a long answer to that question.
I'm speechless for once. Just the stories behind the writer's writing.
Yes.
You know, it's not AI.
No.
Yeah, we deal with real life here. We're talking to Susan J. Eichscheid about her amazing, amazing book, Mistress of Life and Death, The Dark Journey of Maria Mandel, Head Overseer of the Women's Camp at Auschwitz-Birkenau. Let's discuss Miss Maria here, this mean old girl.
Yes.
Tell us about her.
Okay, well, as I mentioned, she was raised in a small town in Austria called Munskirchen. She came from a very good family, a father, mother, three siblings. They were a good Catholic family, a very loving upbringing. As a young woman, she was actually fortunate and unusual to get a job at the local post office because there weren't a whole lot of employment opportunities for young women at that time. She was engaged to be married to a local guy, and Third Reich not intervened. That's probably where she would have remained. But then we had the Austrian Anschluss, which was when Hitler annexed Austria. She was fired from her job at the post office because her family were not National Socialists, ironically. And her fiance dumped her because he became a Nazi and she was not. And he was afraid she would hurt his career down the road. So she was understandably devastated, traveled to Munich, where she had an uncle living, and was looking for work. And he suggested she answer this ad in the paper that was looking for, quote, supervisors for a camp for asocial women and prostitutes. Of course, that was code speak for an early concentration camp. So she got that job. It was the camp of Lichtenberg, which is a little bit south of Berlin. And it was at Lichtenberg where she became sort of indoctrinated and corrupted in what we've come to recognize or call a culture of cruelty. The more cruel you were, the more you were rewarded. She was ambitious. She was angry about her fiancé's dumping. So even though when she came in, people remembered her being very sweet and loving, she got corrupted really very, very quickly, rose through the ranks rapidly, became one of the most brutal overseers there. And then after a year or two, the new women's camp of Ravensbrück was built. It was and then it's north of Berlin. And so she was transferred along with most of the female inmates and a lot of the other guards to kick off that new camp just for women. While there, she would probably became the most brutal at any stage in her life. She was one of the highest ranking female officers. She oversaw the bunker, which was like the prison complex in the camp. I can't even begin to describe the brutalities, and she was responsible for thousands of deaths, many by her own hand. She tortured people. She was famous for being able to kill a woman just by one punch to the jaw. So she was very, very strong. Ultimately became promoted to being head overseer at Ravensbrück, or Oberaufseherin in German, which was the highest rank. And then ultimately she was promoted, although I don't think she viewed it that way, and was transferred to Auschwitz-Birkenau, which of course was the largest death and slave labor camp in Europe and Poland. At her time in Auschwitz, again, she was pretty high ranking, but she continued her string of brutalities, signed various transports lists of transports coming in for the gas chambers, continued her atrocities. Also on the side, founded this orchestra. And in a weird way, it was like the music gave her, I don't know, courage isn't the right word, but it gave her sort of the impetus, like she'd come in and listen to music and it would restore her soul. And then she'd go out and she'd kill. And then she'd come back and sort of refresh herself in the music and go back out and kill. At the end, when Auschwitz was being evacuated, when the Russians were coming in from the east, she was transferred to a camp called Mühldorf, which was outside of Dachau in southern Germany. She did escape the camp about 24 hours before the American army liberated the camp, went home to Austria, where she hid for a couple of months with her sister. But ultimately, someone informed on her and she was arrested. She ultimately was extradited to Poland and tried for crimes against humanity in this huge high-profile war crimes trial in Krakow, and ultimately got the death sentence and was hanged in 1948. So that's sort of a capsule look at her life and what she did.
I think a lot of people believe that it all happened in a vacuum, but there were steps leading up to these internments and the viciousness. And I also believe that the whole Nazi party, if not Germans, were all involved in this situation, in what they did. But it was just like regular people, per se. Some got involved and were evil and did terrible things. Some joined because they were afraid and they sort of stayed on the fringes and weren't involved. If anything, they secretly helped others escape. So why do you think, after spending time with Maria here, why do you think that she became so cruel and she's just this, quote, normal woman who almost, she transformed into this evil person who did evil things? How does that happen?
Well, you know, I've obviously thought a lot about this and about Maria in particular. I do not believe Maria Mendel was intrinsically evil. although, you know, indisputably, she did incredibly evil things, and some of which are beyond any understanding. I think, you know, if you kill a person face to face or torture them before that death, you've certainly crossed this line into what I think is probably the most profound evil of all, taking someone else's life. And she did that over and over and over. As I mentioned, she, like so many others, quickly became indoctrinated in this culture of cruelty, which was encouraged in the camps and also encouraged in society. You know, there was tons of propaganda and negative stereotypes and this depersonalization of the victims. And in her case, she was sort of ripe for the picking because she was coming out of really the sort of the dissolution of the life she had envisioned herself. And it was this opportunity. And I think once she began to kill, it just became easier and easier. And then over the next couple of years, as she descended deeper and deeper into this kind of madness, that became her new normal. Cruelty became the normal rather than any sense of empathy or compassion. Ultimately, she certainly didn't see her victims as human. But I do believe that after the war, after she was arrested and detained, she gradually came out of this kind of madness that she had been in. And I think she began to realize what she had done. From the people I talked to her who knew her at the end before she hanged, and just some of the survivors who had known her before and after, I think there really was sort of a reassessment or reevaluation of her life in her mind, whether or not she ever really accepted guilt or culpability. We do know that shortly before she was executed, she was actually in the prison shower with one of the former inmates of Auschwitz, and she actually sort of crawled over on her knees and begged the woman for forgiveness. You know, so it's hard to say if, you know, how she accepted responsibility or not. I do think she was swept up in this evil and then went along with it. Before it was too late, she just had to keep doing it because that was her life from that point on.
Do you believe she truly bought into the Hitler regime, the Third Reich, Aryan belief? Do you think she truly bought into that? Or was
no. I don't actually, because, you know, really, she was raised, her family was very anti-Nazi, and they didn't believe in those things. I think she ended up spouting those things because that's what she had to do to maintain her job. I think for Maria, it was all about, for the first time in her life, she had power. She had a future. She was getting rewards she couldn't have imagined. So rather than it being like this deep-seated anti-Semitism or hate against Polish people or against other women, I think for her, it was all about suddenly she was powerful. I remember I was talking to one of the survivors of the orchestra. So when I first got to know her, she's like, well, why on earth do you want to write about this woman? And she said, it's very simple. She was a nobody. She became a somebody. That can explain it. And I really think that hit it on the nail in Maria's case, for sure.
I'm reading Mistress of Life and Death by Susan J. Eichscheid. One of the things that Maria Mandel did that just made me put the book down and kind of stare into space is she befriended and loved on these little Jewish children that she pulled from the group, took care of them, fawned all over them, and then took their hands and walked them to the gas chamber.
That was hard for a lot of people. They couldn't begin to, you know, explain that. Some of the women in the orchestra that I interviewed had just very vivid memories, especially of one little boy, you know, it was like a little blonde Polish boy. And, you know, she brought him to rehearsals and would feed him chocolate and kept him in her villa. And then in the end, took him to be killed. I think there was always with Maria. Now, again, I'm not any kind of psychologist, but I've thought a lot about her. I think there was a lot of other layers to her interactions with children. One of the greatest losses of her life was she was very close to her sister, Anna, who had a little boy named Franz Josef, who died at the age of 3 shortly before the war kicked off. And so that was a huge loss for her. Also, in Maria's case, she always wanted to have a baby of her own, a child of her own. Although she engaged in plenty of sexual activity, she never got pregnant. And so we don't know if it was because she was unable to. I think that remained the great tragedies of her life, is that something she desperately wanted but could never have. And there's actually an account at the end after she'd been arrested and extradited to Poland, and they were taking a pretrial deposition. I think one of the interrogators said, well, couldn't you have stopped it at this point? And she said something like, well, if I had had a child, I could have stopped, but I didn't, so I kept going, something like that. So I think there were all these layers. There are accounts of her in the camp. She would go to the children's barracks and bring them candy and play with them. And it was like, I don't know. I think that her bosses and the Nazi regime was telling her, no, you have to kill them. But on the other hand, she was, you know, like, oh, these are kids. I want to have kids. And so it's just this sort of inexplicable, I don't even know, dilemma in her psyche or something that created both of those things. I think she gave into this desire for children and then pulled herself back when she realized that her current position and responsibilities would not allow that, would take the child to the gas chamber and then it would start all over again. But definitely one of the sadder, tragic parts of her story, for sure.
Do you think it was because it was a show of power? I can be nice to you. I can do this. But then I also own you. I literally am your life or death. And it's always going to be death. But children are easy to trick with things like that. And I just wonder if it was in part all about the power and control these people held.
I'm sure that was a good part of it. That was always a big part of what she got out of what she did in her actions. She liked having that power. And again, that was unusual in that time. Women did not have that kind of power. She was always jockeying for power with the male officers. Like, the female SS was an auxiliary branch of the SS, so they weren't considered, you know, fully SS like the men. So she always had to have men over her. And so she was always trying to prove that she was just as powerful and strong and sort of butting heads with the higher ranking male officers. And so I think things like that, she could always just display. She did have the power of life and death. And that's how the book got its title. Her nickname in the camp was Mistress of Life and Death. So I think power for sure was a big part of it.
I wonder if any of them went back to their barracks after their shift or their day of work and literally cried into their pillow and then sort of straightened themselves out, went through the door of their room and became this Nazi puppet. Some of them were just literally puppets.
You know, I don't, having studied it for a while, I don't think that happened very often. And the reason I say that is I also managed to interview another perpetrator who was still living when I started the research. It was a man named Oscar Gröning, who was stationed at Auschwitz as a male SS officer the same time as Maria Mandel. So he agreed to be interviewed, and that kicked off. We had an almost, I don't know, 8-year correspondence. And I really came to, I don't know, respect is perhaps not the right word, but Gröning was one of the few perpetrators I talked to who really sort of realized that he had gone astray. He had been raised in the Hitler Youth. He wasn't, you know, part of the killing process. He was the bookkeeper, so he kept the books. But of course, if you're at Auschwitz, you're involved and you know what's going on. But he would talk about that. He'd say, you know, you were just in this different universe and you got in your head. And, you know, you would go back to the barracks and they would sort of hang out with each other. There was a lot of booze available. And it was just like you, I don't know, you had this capsule around yourself that sort of protected you from the reality of what you were doing. Like, you did, you might be brutally killing somebody, but it was almost like it was someone else doing it and you were in this little bubble of ideology and purpose. So although I'm sure maybe some people did, I'm not sure that Maria did. Perhaps she did with some of the children. But I think a lot of them were in sort of this, like I said, this capsule of ideology that protected them somewhat from the realities of what they were doing.
If you could sit down with her, with Maria Mandel, and just talk, what are some of the questions you would ask her?
Wow, that's a great question. You know, first of all, I think she'd be really pissed off at me for, you know, exposing so much of her life. I really don't. I think I would ask, when did you first kill? How did that happen? What were the circumstances? How did that lead to the other killing? Because to me, that sort of that initial transition when she was at Lichtenberg, when she first began to kill, I think undoubtedly, after you kill, it gets easier. But that first time when she crossed that line, I would be very interested in knowing how that happened. Was it an accident? Was it intentional? I think I would ask her a lot about her family and especially her father, because her father remain the most important figure in her life till the end of her life. When she had guilt and remorse after the war, it was almost always because she was causing him pain and sorrow, and she felt very badly about what her actions had done to her family, and most particularly her father. It was always when I was, you know, I was trying to see both sides of Maria, her good side in quotes, if you will, and of course the bad side was very evident. Sort of the interactions she had with like a close friend that I got to talk to. And then after the war, through this sort of precious but wonderful chance of stroke of luck, I managed to track down a woman who became her good friend when she was in prison and right up to the end of her life. And the woman was still living when I started the research. And so I got to know her very well. And she actually had a letter that Maria's father had written to her at the end of the war. We know that the execution sentences were carried out. Maria, of course, was hanged, but they didn't send any notices to the family. And so he wrote Maria's friend this letter, and it's just so poignant. You know, have you heard anything? We know she got the death sentences, but then we heard that sentences were commuted. It would break my heart. I don't understand how this happened. No one in her family has ever done anything wrong like this. And it's such a great anguish for a father. And so it was sort of in that letter, which is really heartbreaking, that I see more of her humanity or what she was before she became this other thing. So I think if I were to speak with her, I would sort of ask about that transition in her family and her father. And then I think she would probably talk more about the decision she had made in her life.
Talking with Susan J. Eyscheid about her amazing book, Mistress of Life and Death, Maria Mandel, what did you learn about yourself while writing this book, Susan?
You know, I really learned that we all have within ourselves capability for both great good and great evil. Sadly, I also learned that more often than not, throughout history and beyond, you know, most people, or probably more people, are more easily swayed toward evil. I've also struggled and still struggle with questions like, what would I have done had I lived in that period? You know, maybe in circumstances were always making judgments on decisions people made, but I'm uncomfortable with that unless, you know, we've each faced that personal crucible. I'd like to think I'm the kind of person who would have hidden someone Jewish during the war, even with the knowledge that you yourself would be killed if you were discovered. That was the penalty. And so then I start keep thinking, well, maybe I would accept that risk for myself, but then would you still hide the person if you knew not only your own life was risked, but they'd also killed everyone in your family or your friends? And then sort of on a more mundane level, would you still hide someone if you didn't really like that person? You know, so there are so many levels to the kinds of choices that people face then. I think a lot about that and how easily it would be to go one direction or the other. Certainly with Maria's story, I think she very much illustrates how very easy it is for hate and evil to take root and flourish in an otherwise normal person, if you will. Certainly then, and especially as we're seeing today, there was and had been and has been sort of this constant erosion of empathy as things like, you know, hate speech, rhetoric, propaganda — the Nazis were masters of propaganda — what we can now call false news, all these really insidious things have become normalized. They're normal rather than aberrant. And, you know, when that happens, empathy erodes or gets eroded. And in my mind, when empathy goes, that's really the ball game. That's when evil can creep in and flourish. So that's the biggest lesson I take, is that we really have to fight against those things and just be constantly aware, speak out against them, and do everything we can to maintain a sense of empathy towards everybody. And then, you know, fight for those things as we continue forward in our own lives. And that's surely what I'm trying to do.
Absolutely, because everyone has it in themselves to murder. A lot of times it depends on the situation. It depends on your environment.
Yep.
And the people around you.
And you certainly know that better than anybody. And also your upbringing, everything comes into it.
Right, right. Because you would think, you know, off the top of your head, okay, so her wedding was canceled. Why would that make her so angry? But it's not just that one situation.
Right.
It's not a vacuum. It just, there's so much involved. Is there anything else you'd like us to know about this book, about yourself, about the writing process?
just, I would love for people to read the book, to think about themselves and their own lives, sort of fully see all sides of this one person and how easily she was swayed toward evil, and maybe just treat everyone you can with more compassion and understanding, because it's a scary world we live in, and I'd really like for it to have a good impact to help people think about perhaps some things they haven't thought about before.
Talking with Susan J. Eichscheid about her book, Mistress of Life and Death, The Life of Maria Mandel. Where can we purchase this book?
You can get it in any of the major booksellers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any of the independent booksellers, IndieBound. If you want, you can get a link on my website, which is seischeid.com. And that can channel you to any of the places where you can order books or where you would like to order books. And I would surely appreciate that. In all the campsites, and I've been in all of the places that Maria worked, including Ravensbrück, I thought it would help, you know, I wanted to be in that place. And so I would just sit there and try to absorb the atmosphere. And for those homes that they built for the female overseers at Ravensbrück, I mean, they're very lovely accommodations. I mean, these were better than things that most of them had at home. And you can see that, you know, they came back from work at night and they went to this beautiful home, and it's like they phased out the concentration camp that was right, you know, down the hill. And then they go back into work. And so they really compartmentalize their life. And so, you know, just being in those environments and seeing that, it helps you understand a little better, I guess, how they were able to sort of dissociate, although I'm not sure I could have. But the Nazis did everything they could to make that attractive to them, to sort of aid in that part of it, I guess.
How about walking the grounds of these camps?
Well, I'll tell you, Auschwitz, I was first there right after the wall fell. And so the camp was not very visited at that time. There hadn't been a lot of sort of rehabilitation. I'm not sure what you would call it, renovation. But, you know, they're trying to keep it. And it was absolutely haunting, because you would go in these barracks and they were very much as they had been when they were evacuated. In more recent years, that has become much more touristy. I'm having a little trouble with that. The places have gotten a little more cleaned up, but you can still, there are certain places in all the camps that I think are especially, I don't know, overwhelming. Like there was a woman's barrack at Auschwitz-Birkenau called Block 25. And that is where a lot of the women, they were condemned to death in this election. They'd be thrown in there naked and they'd have to stay in there 2 or 3 days until they had a break in the transports and they'd be taken to the gas chambers. People vividly remember those women that, you know, they're barred, they're calling out the windows for water. They knew they were going to be killed. Just enormous suffering. When I walked in that barrack for the first time, you know, it was a warm, warm day. I walked in, it was literally 30 degrees colder. And you could just sense this palpable presence of these lives and spirits that had been there. It still remains one of the most overwhelming experiences I've had. And some of the other camps, for example, Majdanek, which was the big camp outside of Lublin in Poland. Again, I went there first very early on in my research. And if you go to Majdanek, I don't know, when I went, it was a November day, so it was gray. It was there. There was literally no one else at the campsite. And I saw this big structure off in the distance. It was like this big dome, almost as big as like half of a football field or something, very large structure. And I was like, oh, that's strange. I wonder what that is. And you could see the barracks off to the right. And so I walked up to the dome and you looked down and it was just filled with human ashes and bones. I mean, you know how much ashes compress. So just how many people that was overwhelming. And then out of nowhere, this guard came up on the right. And of course, my Polish is not great. I maybe have 12 words hard learned, and he didn't speak English. But he gestured towards this crematorium building and like, do you want to see in there? And I'm like, okay. And again, totally deserted. I'm the only person with him. And so he took me over and unlocked it. And that was very much as it existed when it was liberated. There were still bones and femurs and things in the ovens. They had like a dissecting table that still had blood stains. And now again, that's all been cleaned up in later years as the camps have been more open. But that initial experience was so overwhelming. And then he walked me through into this section where they have actually, most of the gas chambers at Auschwitz, most of them had been, were blown up at the end of the war. But at Majdanek, some of the gas chambers still exist and you can walk into them. And there's like this blue stains on the wall from the gas that they use, the Zyklon B. And I remember walking over and putting my hand on the side of the wall. And my fingers fell into these grooves where someone, as they were dying, had clawed out of the concrete, these claw marks. It was such a visceral, overwhelming experience. It really sort of brought home the reality that of all this work I had been doing, these were real people who died and suffered. And so it really inspired me to be just as committed as I could to telling their story honestly and fairly. But yeah, that was it's very overwhelming to embark on visits like that, for sure.
I did a podcast on these people that are going to these memorials and taking selfies or doing something that they thought was funny. And yes. It is just...
I know, it's awful.
It would ruin the whole experience for me. And I would have to say something, and then there would be a row of these people taking cute little selfies of themselves, or, you know, throwing the peace sign, or just, I don't understand that mindset unless they just don't, maybe they're blocking the thought.
Just don't understand the reality of what they're seeing, or maybe don't take it seriously, or it's very disturbing. I've seen that quite often in recent years.
Talking to Susan J. Eyscheid about her wonderful book, Mistress of Life and Death. It's the story of Maria Mandel, who was one of the most feared women in Germany, worked at the concentration camps, took a lot of lives, eventually paid with her own life. Only a small percentage of these people were actually taken to court, especially women. And so many of them just kind of faded back into the world and went about their normal business. The same women who killed and bludgeoned and beat, tortured these people in these camps.
Thousands of them that just, like you said, reverted to their former lives. Very few were prosecuted and tried.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it wasn't just the women. There were a lot of men who did that too.
Yes.
I think the more notorious women got a lot of press, like Irma Graiza, who you're writing about. I can't wait for that book to hit. People like Ilse Koch, who was famous for the lampshades made out of human skin. She was the wife of one of the commandants of Buchenwald. But then I don't know. There was even the press coverage of Mandel's trial. It's like, it's hard for us to believe the fairer sex, a woman, could engage in these brutalities. And so I think for a long time, there's just this perception that the women weren't as brutal. And, you know, apart from these few cases, which people thought were maybe aberrant, you know, and then, you know, by then years had passed and the women were assimilated back into their life. You know, that's a great question, but I think it was maybe just attitudes towards what women were capable of at the time and perhaps how that's changed now.
Susan, thank you so much for talking to me and talking about your book, Mistress of Life and Death. And thank you for sharing your knowledge. And you don't know how much I appreciate you coming on today and talking to us. And again, the book is called Mistress of Life and Death. It is available wherever fantastic books are sold. You can buy that online, and then you can also go to her website.
Right. It's my first initial of my first name and my last name, which I'll spell SEISCHEID.com.
Fantastic. If you're listening to this, and you better be, you need to go out there, buy that book, and learn something about yourself, learn something about history. So, Susan, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. I surely appreciate this. Thank you so much.
Hey, listeners, this is Judith A. Yates, reminding you that it is getting cold outside. And while you're inside staying warm, your pets should be warm too. Even if it's just the garage or in the barn, get your pet some hay or straw to curl up in to stay warm. You should keep your cats and dogs inside when the temperature falls below 40 degrees outside, even dogs with thick fur. Antifreeze is a deadly poison. It has a sweet taste that attracts animals, so be sure and clean up any spilled antifreeze. Check your car's hood before starting the car. Either bang on the hood or honk your horn, because cats and small animals will crawl up in the engine space to stay warm, and you don't want to start your engine with an animal in there. Clean off paws if you suspect your dogs or your cats have walked through rock salt, because they'll lick their feet and that rock salt in their system is not good. Cats should never be left outdoors, even if they roam outside during other seasons. Bring them in. And remember, a pet carrier is not a doghouse. If you need a doghouse and are having hard times financially, you can usually find them for free. Check Craigslist under the free listings, and you can usually find them if you keep your eye open. Always provide fresh drinking water in the winter. And for more information, go to www.aspca.org. Let's leave animal abusers out in the cold. Let's not leave the animals. Thank you for joining me on this investigation, exploring true crime, forensics, historic cases, dark history, and criminal theory. This is Best True Crime Podcast. No chatter, no commercials, no off topic. I do hope you will subscribe. This podcast runs off donations only. You can drop us a donation, $35 or more, and I'll send you a signed book. Just go to www.besttruecrime.com. My name is Judith A. Yates, award-winning true crime author, a criminologist, and a paranormal explorer. Thank you for joining me on Best True Crime Podcast, a division of Best True Crime Books, Games, and Video, LLC. Be safe out there.